Do you have enough money to make ends meet? Are you saving a small portion of your income? How can you maximize your income while paying off your debt? What are you doing to manage your money to make it work for you? We as Christians are taught to be frugal with our resources and to live within our means. Sometimes life gets in the way and we don't have the appropriate amount of income coming in to help us maintain a stable budget, yet alone save for emergencies. We hope we can give you biblical knowledge and financial tips to assist you in maintaining a frugal budget for you and your family.
The Ear, Evangelical and Reformed Christian Podcast. Welcome to The Ear, the Evangelical and Reformed, a Christian podcast that urges you to think deeper and draws you closer to God through faith. Through powerful sermons, teaching segments, and discussions, The Ear hopes to give you a different perspective on secular topics from a Christian worldview. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Please welcome your host, Brandon Queen.
My name is Brandon Queen, and it is a joy and a privilege to be the host of The Ear and bring you Christian and biblical commentary on topics the secular realm often get wrong. Here on The Ear, we hope to give you the different perspectives on the secular topics from a Christian worldview while tackling and talking about the biblical topics we as Christians also get wrong. During today's episode, we have the honor to having a finance and health coach give us tips and strategies to make our money work for us. We will answer the questions most might struggle with when it comes to our finances. We have the privilege of hosting Brennan Faulks and his business Under One Love during this season. Hey, Brennan, welcome back, and thanks for joining us again for another episode of Living Financially Balanced.
All right, man. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here again.
Awesome, awesome. So last week, we just talked about the basics of finances and what are finances. Today, we're going to take a look at how to make our money work for us and what are some things we can do to, I guess, maximize our income or extra cash flow or whatever we have to make it work for the best of our ability. So with that being said, what are some tips that you have in mind before we get into the question and answer?
Well, first things first, right? Back to kind of what we talked about last week. You got to have a budget. You've got to set up all of your finances so that you know exactly how much is coming in, exactly how much is going out, so that that extra amount that's left over after all of your expenses are covered, you can be really diligent with. The second biggest thing is our biggest wealth building tool, the best way that we can make our money work for us and we can make our money grow is by raising our income. Your biggest wealth building tool is your income. So the bigger you get your income and the less your expenses are, if you can keep your expenses the same, not increase your lifestyle, but raise your income, then now you can really start to have some big deficits that are going to work in your favor.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. So if one does have a low income job and is a single parent, what are some things that they can do to actually make their money work for them?
Good question. So I get this often. A lot of people that I work with are in the same type of situation. So it's one of these things where you don't have a lot of time, but you do still have some time. And so everyone who's in that position, I would challenge them to make sure that things like the television are turned off. You're not spending a lot of time on your phone. You're not doing a lot of extra curricular type activities. You want to make sure that you're being extremely focused on work parenting your children, and then doing anything and everything you can within that time that you would normally be watching TV or something like that, be doing things in those time that are going to create income. I always tell people, you can make money doing almost anything in this country. So there's really no excuse not to make extra money. And I've recorded a few videos and you know, made some posts and things about this topic, but we are created in the image of our Creator, and He is a hard worker. God is a hard worker. He has designed us to be like Him. And even before the fall of man, He has designed us to work. So I have my personal belief that we are designed to work and work hard, and we should be working with a lot of our time to help create income and provide stability for our family, even if we're single parents. Outside of that, you know, we could get into investing and things like that. But again, just like we talked about last week, there's a process in which you want to do these things. Because if you try to start investing right now before, let's say, your debt is paid off, you're going to be running in two opposite directions and not getting in either direction very quickly.
Wow. Very, very powerful. Okay. So I have a lot of folks that I know that are single parents, and they are hard workers. Mm-hmm. But they sometimes fall short, and they can't get enough income or enough capital to keep a stable budget going. You know, they'll have to either work a second job or find work in other places, and they're hardly ever home to actually raise their children. And you'll probably get this in a two-parent home as well, where the father is out working a very good job and the mom is at home, but the mom is responsible with keeping the house clean and mm-hmm. keeping watch over the children and making sure they're being brought up in the right way.
Right.
But I've seen both sides. I've seen both spectrums where the father does all the work, the mother stays at home and does the raising part, and then they come together and kind of co-parent as they should. But then I've also seen the struggling parent, the single parent, you know, having to struggle to make ends meet, especially those fathers that want to be a part of their child's lives, but they're stuck paying child support, you know? So there's a huge problem with American people, if you will. Now, last week you said that America, or Americans are wealthy. And I kind of want you to clarify that, because I did agree with you on that, but I want you to clarify, what do you mean by wealthy when you said that?
Okay, so in the broad spectrum, Americans are wealthy compared to the rest of the world. We have so much availability to income and so many resources at our fingertips that it comes down to making good decisions, being consistent, and committing yourself to do something that nobody else wants to do. And that's why no one else is, you know, financially fit. There's a statistic that says that a immigrant that comes to this country is four times more likely to become a millionaire than someone who's native born in this country. So what does that tell you? These are some
lazy.
Yeah, it's an incredible statistic. This is someone who is, number one, probably a minority as far as the, you know, as far as the country is concerned. Number two, they have the exact same opportunities as we have, but they have something different inside of them. And that something different is they've had probably a more difficult life, and they're coming here because they see how much opportunity is here and they capitalize on that. A lot of people who are natively born here don't capitalize on any opportunity that's around them, and they don't rack their brain and really use their time to the best of their ability to make more money and to provide a better lifestyle for their family. And also, they're not frugal, right? They don't spend wisely. So their time and their money are just being wasted. You got, you know, like what you mentioned, I see a lot of the same things that you just talked about with people that I work with. So let's take, for example, the family who, you know, the dad works full time and the mom is raising the kids and keeping the house. In that circumstance, if we really, you know, do the math and look at this, the dad is probably working, let's just, for the sake of this conversation, say 40 hours a week, and then let's count for 2 hours a day of drive time. That's a really long commute, but in a big city like where I live, that's, you know, that's pretty, average. So let's say that the dad is gone for, 50 hours a week. That's 10 hours a day. There's still, what is that, 14 hours left in that day and only 8 to 6 of those are sleep. So realistically, you should be really proactive in those other 6 to 8 hours that you're awake and not at work. That's raising kids, that's helping mom keep the house, and then that's doing something to provide more income. Like what I said, you can make money doing anything. So find something you're passionate about and figure out a way to make some extra money. Start a, you know, start some kind of business, or go deliver someone's groceries, or like Dave Ramsey says, buy a leaf blower and start blowing leaves, because rich people are afraid of leaves. There's a number of ways that we can make this stuff work. So, and then, you know, with the single parent, yes, it's harder. But my mom raised me and my brother almost completely by herself. And a lot of times she worked 3 jobs at a time to provide for us. And I think I mentioned that before.
Yeah.
Now that's not what every single parent has to do to make it work. And if my mom had been a little bit more wise with her money and the decisions she was making and understanding biblical financial principles, not getting into debt and all these types of things, not having a bunch of payments, she could have been a lot more effective with that income that she was bringing in, and it would have changed the game completely. So with single parents, it's even more important that they are very diligent with their time. They're scheduling their life instead of just leaving it to an employer to schedule them. They're finding other ways that they can create more income as opposed to just going to a full-time job that's not paying them what their value is. You know, understanding your value and what you can provide to the marketplace is essential, because then you can figure out how much to charge for a specific thing that you are passionate about.
Perfect. Perfect. All right. So I want to shift gears with the next question and ask this. And let's see. So I used to get grief from my sisters and my brothers for saving coins. Okay. From cash purchases. Like, for example, if I would have cash on me, I would save the coins, and they wouldn't give me like harsh grief. They would just make fun of me and call me an old man. Do you think it's worth saving coins, and can that system or process benefit you in the future?
Yes. It's not going to be huge, but we have to remember, in this entire financial picture, it's so much more about the behavior than it is about the numbers. So when I'm coaching people, when I'm working with people, every little step that you make forward in the forward direction is beneficial to your overall picture. So something like saving coins, it's not just about, oh, I saved 10 cents here, a quarter there, whatever. It's about, I'm creating the behavior to understand that I am a manager of the money that God has blessed me with. And now it's up to me to do what's right with that money according to his instruction. And so, you know, a lot of people will just throw their change in the parking lot or whatever. You know, I, even though it's a small amount of the money that you have been blessed with, that you're just kind of, you know, let's say you're dropping pennies in the parking lot on the way out of the store or whatever, because you don't want to carry it. That's not just about the penny. It's about the behavior that's behind you dropping the penny, which is a sense of, you know, not showing as much care as you should toward this whole thing. If you start to develop habits and behaviors to really pay close attention to what's coming in and what's going out and what you're doing with the extra that's coming in, then after you build that habit, you're going to really start to see changes in your financial picture.
Yeah, perfect. I remember, I think I was like 22, 23. I had a job interview with Boy Scouts. I was going to go work in Mississippi in Gulfport. And I had the cash to get to and from Mississippi, like the gas and everything. Mm-hmm. But I purposely, and I only showed my sister this because I wanted her to see why I did what I did. So I took my coins and I literally sat there the day before and hand wrapped every single coin in every single category, and she helped me, and we ended up raising, or I ended up counting $40. Mm-hmm. And it literally cost me $40 to the T to get to and from Mississippi from Louisiana.
Yeah.
So when she saw that, she was like, well, how long it took you to save the coins? And I told her, I said, well, at the time, at every paycheck, I was pulling about $20 for myself to last me for the 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, just kind of not touching my account, but just pulling cash and keeping the cash, and whatever comes off of the cash, I recycle the coins. Well, she saw the value in that, and now she does it.
There you go.
So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. That's really cool. Yeah. We keep all of our change, you know, when we spend the cash, we bring the change home and we put it into a little tin can, and probably every 6 months, we've got a good $40-$50 in coins. And
right.
Yeah. A lot of people would just, you know, leave that somewhere or misplace it or whatever the case is. And that's when you look at it like, oh, you know, if it was a $50 bill, would you just set it down in the parking lot? Of course not.
Right.
So
right.
it's again, it comes down to, you know, the behavior change and the responsibility that is endowed to you that you have to take seriously. I want to look at something earlier that you mentioned about not having the income to maintain a stable budget. Can you clarify?
Okay, so
what you mean?
Let's say a single parent has two jobs, and one's a full time job, but it's only giving her 30 hours a week, and she's making $10.75 an hour. Okay, and her second job is cleaning houses, and she's got like four or five houses to clean, and she's making about $120 per house. All right. But she just went through a divorce. Her job at the time wasn't technically needed. She just wanted to work. So she went through a divorce and she has no other income but the income she basically brought to the table, because she's not having the financial status or the financial support coming from the husband because they split up. So she had to get a small apartment with her and her kids. Let's say the apartment cost $750 a month, two-bedroom apartment, one bath. And like, let's say her light bill was, I don't know, $200, so forth and so on. You know, like she has to adjust her lifestyle. She has to adjust her living. But what if she does all of that, adjusts her living, cuts back on a lot of things, but still doesn't make the money to basically make ends meet? That's kind of what I'm getting at.
Okay. So I just wanted to clarify because I'm, you know, It's really important to understand what a budget is, and I didn't know if that was the direction of the question. So just to clarify that, a budget is you telling your money what to do. It's not. People have so many misconceptions about a budget and what it is, and they think that it's just some restriction plan to, you know, take away their money. It's a game plan for you to tell your money what to do, and then it keeps you accountable. So you're deciding everything that's on this budget. Like you said, with a single parent, they are going to have to really, look at their lifestyle and take it down, most likely, because they just don't have the income to keep up with the current lifestyle that they have. Now, it's, you know, unfortunately not in every case can a single parent receive child support if there are kids, obviously, but that should be something, you know, this is a moral issue as far as I'm concerned, but that should be something that is absolutely mandatory, maybe even alimony, because if you have a stay-at-home parent who is now divorced and is going to live and keep the kids and then has to go and get a job after 10 years of marriage, well, now you have an adult who hasn't spent any time building any type of career or providing anything to the marketplace and then trying to go out and find a job to support the family, you know, so there's that side of this coin also. That's something we have to consider. And hopefully in most cases there would be child support as well as maybe alimony. But again, it comes down to, it's that much more important for a single parent to be extremely diligent and focused so that they can make the most of their time and provide a good income for their family. And you know, I keep going back to this. You have to understand what your value is. Don't sell yourself short and go and wait tables for the next 10 years. I'm okay with you doing that, you know, as a side job to make some extra money and get the ball rolling a little bit, but you really need to develop yourself, get some kind of skills, training, whatever it is, and provide something of much more value to the marketplace. Because like I said, in this country, we can make money doing just about anything. And, you know, people will pay a significant amount of money for a lot of different skills that they themselves don't have.
Right. Okay. Sweet. Thank you for that. Now, when is a safe time, or when is it safe to start investing?
So in the process that we teach, you want to start investing after your fully funded emergency fund is fully funded. So that's the 3 to 8 months worth of household expenses. And that comes after you've paid off all of your debt except for your mortgage. The reason we wait until then is because we want to use every portion of income after our expenses are covered to attack these steps and knock out these goals, or else, like I've said, we're not going to get in either direction very quickly at all. Whereas if we pay off the debt with extreme intensity, with every extra dollar that's coming into the house, and then once the debt is gone, now we start saving our fully funded emergency fund. Now that we have that fully funded emergency fund, we've got a really good buffer zone between us and life. We can reach our medical deductions on our insurance if we have some kind of medical emergency. We can reach our deduction on our vehicles if we get in an accident or whatever it is. We can cover an issue that happens at the house if the heat and air system goes out. Well, we have the money saved in an emergency fund specifically for emergencies that we can now cover those things with. And so now it's safe to start using that extra money that's coming in to go towards investing. And the point to putting it off until the fourth step and after you finish these other steps is you're going to be a lot more diligent with your investing and a lot more purpose driven with your investing if you leave it in this point of the process. Because if you're just trying to invest a few dollars here and there, you're really not doing anything beneficial as far as investing is concerned anyway. So you might as well just put those, you know, extra $25 or whatever you're investing per month towards some of your debts and then free up more of your income so that later you can invest a lot more. And again, we're getting to this point, you know, we're paying off our debt in, let's say, 1 to 3 years. In most cases, it's right around 2 years. And then we're saving up that fully funded emergency fund in about another year. So we're looking at a total of 4 years that you're not investing. But then once you start investing, you're really investing as much as you possibly can. Whereas if you're trying to do it before that, you're just not really making any headway at all. So you're not losing a lot of time in this point in the process.
Okay. So how long will it take for someone to build a fully funded emergency account? And also to add to that question, how much should be in that fully funded emergency account? I know you said 6 to 8 months, but what does 6 to 8 months look like with a dollar sign in front of it?
Okay. Yeah. So 3 to 8 months. Let's just say that your household expenses are $4,000. Okay. $4,000 a month on average is what you spend. That's covering all of your housing, your vehicles, your food, your clothing, just everything that you need to live. Notice that I said need, not want. So once all of your expenses are covered, $4,000 worth, you're going to multiply that by anywhere from 3 to 8. This is the amount of months. It's up to you to decide, do I want to save 3 months worth of expenses or do I want to save 8 months worth of expenses? So if your expenses are $4,000 and you want to save, let's say, 5,000 or 5 months, you're going to multiply 4,000 by 5, and that's $20,000. So you want to have $20,000 in your emergency fund, and that is the total of 5 months worth of your living expenses. So now here's another thing. Let's say that you lose your job and there's no income for 3 months. Well, you have covered your living expenses for those 3 months with your emergency fund. And then once you get another job, now you can start to rebuild your emergency fund and then get back on track with the step that you're currently in.
Okay, so I get it, but I want to make sure it's crystal clear for the listeners. Absolutely. So let's say I bring home $2,500 per pay. Okay, I bring home $5,000 a month. Okay. How am I supposed to save up to $4,000 times 8 or times 3 or times 5 or whatever in that process?
So if you're, again, the more diligent we are with our budget and the lower we keep our expenses, we're living within our means. If you're making $5,000 a month and you're spending $4,000 a month, then you're saving $1,000 per month. So if it's going to be, you know, 5 months, $20,000, that's going to take you 20 months. It's going to take you a year, almost 2 years to do that. So this point in the process, like I said, you're going to be in this between step two and step three. Step two is going to be 1 to 3 years. Step three, the fully funded emergency fund, is going to be another 1 to 2 years. So you're going to be at this before you're investing for, let's just say, 4 years on average.
Okay, perfect. All right, that's clarified. Thank you. So Now I know you are not a fan of debt, okay? But how much debt is too much debt? And I know the answer to this, but again, I want the listeners to know how much debt is too much debt.
Well, I'm very consistent and very precise, and any debt is too much debt. There's no amount of debt that we need in this country or that we should have. This is a major lie that runs so deep into our culture since, I don't know, maybe the 1940s, 1950s. Your great-great-grandparents, they viewed debt almost as a sin. Like, it was something that, oh yeah, you know, so-and-so neighbor has debt. Ugh, that's terrible. Whereas now, it's just commonplace. Like, everyone has debt for every single thing. We borrow money to get things that we can't afford. The only reason that we're using debt is because we can't purchase with our own money what we want. And everything that we call ours is not actually ours. It belongs to the bank, right? When we create this cycle of using other people's money as if it's some kind of wealth building tool, we get ourselves into significant traps that are, they're extremely dangerous. And the scriptures are super duper clear on not borrowing for any particular circumstance and the type of issue that it can get you in, as well as how to get out of debt if you basically are forced to borrow by no other possible route. There's almost no circumstance that you need to borrow money. And so, you know, you get the question like, oh, well, how are we going to get a house? And we can get into that maybe on some other episodes. But I'm a huge fan of the 100% down plan. And every time I say that, I get some ridiculous looks like I'm crazy, but it's really not as hard as a lot of people think. And when we do the numbers, we can see that. But it comes down to, is your behavior going to be consistent enough and diligent enough to get you there?
Oh, yeah. Perfect. You see, Americans are not disciplined enough like they should be when it comes to financial stability. And I mean, look, I'm guilty of it myself. I took out a loan to go to school. That didn't pay off too well, you know. Yeah, so, no, I mean, yeah, we're not you're right. This is something that we need to talk about more and we need to like pull ourselves out of. That's why I was so adamant about you explaining how in the world is one going to save 5 to 8 months of expenses into an emergency account. And look, I'm actually working on this same process right now with my own finances because I think it's important and I want to have that buffer just in case something happens.
Right.
Like I said, right now I'm just saving $25 here, $25 there. I'm saving more than that, but you know, I'm saving small amounts right now until I can get myself to where I can save the extra $1,500 a month, which I'm very close to doing now versus just saving $1,000 a month. All right. Sure. So moving on to the next question. What is good debt? I know that's a redundant question, but what is good debt?
So this is another lie that's been told to us that there's such a thing as good debt. There's not. Right. The Bible's clear. The borrower is the slave to the lender. So we need to ask ourselves, and there's, okay, one of the pushbacks is, oh, the usage of the word slave there in that verse is not completely accurate. It should be more like servant. And that's fine. We can use the word servant. So the borrower is servant to the lender. In a lot of cases, being a servant in biblical talk is a good thing. But in this case, it is a negative. So when you look at the context of the verse, it's a negative to be the servant of the person who's lending you money. And so we have to ask ourselves, do I really want to be a servant to Chase Bank or Ashley Furniture or Quicken Loans or Chevy? Absolutely not. I don't want to be a servant to them or slave to them. I want to make my own decisions and I don't want to sign myself up to whatever stipulations they want me to follow. right? So there's no such thing as good debt, using debt to somehow get ahead in life. It's a terrible cycle that gets us into so much risk and so many traps. So earlier with the, when you asked me, how are we going to save this amount of money for our emergency fund? I gave you an expense amount of $4,000. Now, realistically, once you've paid off all of your debt, your expenses are going to be down significantly more than that because you have no more payments except for maybe a mortgage, right? So your car payment is gone, your credit card payments are gone, your medical payments are gone, whatever debts you have, your student loan, all those payments are gone. So your expenses really should be down probably somewhere around $1,000. So really, if you're bringing home $5,000, you should only be spending about $3,000 and saving $2,000 a month. So we could cut that time in half. But the problem with debt is, again, like I said in the beginning, your biggest wealth building tool is your income. So if we have a whole bunch of payments that are taking away our income, all we're doing is going to work to pay for stuff and then going back to work to keep paying for stuff. And it's just this cycle of working, paying for stuff, working, paying for stuff, working, paying for stuff. And we're never getting anywhere. We might have a nice car. We might have a nice house. We might go on nice vacations with the credit card. We may have gotten a degree at a out-of-state school that we could have gotten in-state for a third of the cost. And all those things are fine, you know, whatever. It looks good. You feel good. But the problem is you have nothing and you're creating this lifelong cycle of having nothing and having to work until you're 90 years old.
Yeah, I plan to do that anyway.
I mean, if you do what you love, that's fine. That's totally fine. Work as long as you want to. I plan on working for a long time too because I love what I do. But the thing is, we don't want to be working just so we can keep our stuff. If you have a car payment and you don't make that payment, someone comes and takes your car. Okay? If you own your car, guess what? Now you have an option. When you don't have payments, you have options. If your boss is being a jerk and you hate your job, you leave your job because you're not forced to keep that job. You're no longer a servant to the people who are lending you money because no one's lending you money. This is the design that the Father has in his infinite wisdom created for us to live freely and not in debt, not in servitude to anyone except for him. And our obviously, you know, serving our brothers and sisters is a different type of servitude than serving someone who's, you know, just lending you something.
Amen. All right. Okay. So should I give up extracurricular activities for a few months?
Give me another layer to that question.
So I don't really like fantasy football, but I'm gonna use fantasy football. I like fantasy football. Okay. And I pay X amount of dollars a month to be a part of a fantasy football club team, whatever. I like golf. Mm-hmm. I like fishing. I like hunting. I like shooting guns. I like, you know, all the extra stuff that I do to occupy my time that also costs money. Should I give that up for a couple months?
So we get back to behavior. Let me leave you with something to think about. Children, they do what they like and what feels good to them. Adults analyze the situation and they do what's responsible. They make a plan and they stick to that plan.
Okay.
So you a question to ask yourself when you're thinking about that, should I give up XYZ? The real question behind this whole thing is, am I going to do what feels good and continue to do what feels good, even though it's costing me so much in my future? Or am I going to make specific plans and follow them? Because if we will give up the things that feel good right now for a short time frame, short-term sacrifice, it's going to result in long-term gain. Whereas if we never make short-term sacrifices and we never give up these things that feel good, all the luxuries, the extra bills, the extra fun, if we never give those things up, we're going to make long-term sacrifice and have no gain. I mean, we'll have a little bit of short-term gain in the moment because it's fun, but that's really the end of it. So you have to look forward and think, what's more important to me? Having a better future, being able to have a lot of time and freedom when I'm older and have kids and grandkids, etc., or doing what I like right now? What's more important to me?
Perfect. Perfect. All right. For my last question of the evening, what are some best practices I can use to keep track of my progress?
So what we do is we list out all of the steps that we teach on, steps 1 through 7, save your starter emergency fund, pay off your debt, save your fully funded emergency fund, then start investing into kids' college, pay off the house early if you have a house, and then the last step is to live and give with extreme generosity and just, you know, really living up this life that you've built and just giving like it's your job. So we write down those steps and we focus on them following one at a time until we get to the later steps. And the way you're going to track this, the longest part of your process is going to be paying off the debt, step number 2, and saving up the fully funded emergency fund, step number 3. So like with the debt, for example, the way you keep track of your progress is you list all of your debts from smallest debt to largest debt. You make minimum payments on every single debt, and then you pay off the smallest debt with every bit of extra income that you have with a vengeance. You pay it off like your life depends on you paying it off. And then once you get that first debt gone, the smallest one, you move on to the next biggest one. And this drives the math nerds crazy because they think, oh, well, we should pay off highest interest rate first because it makes the most sense. But the problem is a lot of times the debt with the highest interest rate is also one of the larger debts. And what we found is if you don't get some small wins along the way, you're going to burn out and probably give up. So it comes full circle back to this whole idea of personal finance is personal. It's about behavior. We have to create the behavior. We have to create the habits. So paying off these smaller debts to start out, you get some wins and you start to believe. You pay off a $2,000 debt, you're excited. You pay off the next debt, which is $4,000, you're really excited. And then you're looking at this, you know, $10,000, $20,000, whatever the student loan is, and you're like, oh yeah, I can do this. Okay, so you have to create this pattern and this behavior to help yourself believe and stay motivated and finish.
Yeah, finish strong. I remember I actually got a couch and I put it on loan and I paid it off before a year and I was super excited about that. So yeah, when you start paying off the small stuff, you do feel more accomplished.
Yeah,
I actually highly recommend that people do that. I'm still trying to figure out a way to tackle my student loan. Because I was paying $225 a month when my minimum payments was only like, I think, $150. But the problem was I'm paying the extra money, but it's not doing anything for the student loan. So I'm still trying to find ways to knock that down and either just pay on the interest or, you know, whatever. But, you know, paying off the small stuff first, it gives you more wiggle room to focus on the large stuff when they do come up.
That's right, because at the same time that you're getting motivated and starting to believe, you're also eliminating payments, right?
Right, absolutely.
So what are you doing when you're eliminating payments? Well, you're creating more extra income to throw at the next biggest debt. So it's working in two ways. You're getting rid of debts, but you're also freeing up income to get rid of the next biggest debt.
Right, absolutely. All right, so Brennan, do me a favor. Give us a biblical reference to close out this segment.
Okay, well, I said it earlier. I'll just quote I'll let you know which verse it is. It's Proverbs 22:7. Since we talked about debt, it's fitting. It says the borrower is servant to the lender. And then I think it goes on to say, but the wealth of the wicked is laid up for the righteous or something like that. But the point is, whoever's borrowing money is a servant, or borrowing anything, you are now a servant to the person or entity that you're borrowing from. And this is not a good place to be. This is not a positive in the scriptures. This is a negative. This is something we are to avoid at all costs. We should not be doing this. If we have that behavior and that mentality, and we stop looking at our, you know, if we stop looking with the view of borrowing is how we get stuff, then we're going to set ourselves up for success. Whereas if we keep thinking with this broken mindset that how we get stuff is by borrowing, like how I get a new car is by borrowing instead of using our money and our cash, then, you know, that's going to get us into a world of trouble, if not already. Around my household, we move at the speed of cash. If we don't have the cash to buy something, we don't buy it because that means we cannot afford it. That's why we have to go and borrow in the first place.
I do that when I go to Walmart because I hate Walmart. Walmart is set up to make you buy things you don't need.
Believe it or not, almost every single entity is very aggressive on their marketing to make sure that you buy more than what you need. It's the way our culture is set up. We're a consumer nation, and all of these companies, all of these businesses, they know that and they capitalize on it, and it works.
Right. Yeah. I'll go to Walmart and I'll literally ask myself this one little question. Do I need this or do I want it? And if the I want it comes up, I leave it alone. But I'm disciplined enough to do that. So I'm also disciplined enough to boycott Walmart half the time. But anyway. Yeah.
Well, no, and it's really something to pay attention to because, you know, you as a consumer, me as a consumer, we really have to be aware of this because it's not, I mean, this isn't a game. This is a business for these people. Everything in the store is on purpose. The placement of the products on the shelves being at eye level, the most popular expensive products being at eye level, the gums and the candies and all those things being at the register. I mean, this is all on purpose. I don't know if you've been, my wife sometimes goes to the craft store and asks me to go with her. And on the way to the register, you walk through an entire lane of, you know, candies and snacks and just like little knickknacks, chargers and things like that. You have to follow that route to get to the register. And that's on purpose. That we have to understand that as consumers. These things are there to make you impulse and buy things that you don't need, and it works. So you knowing that, you can avoid it.
Yeah, and I just wish most people would actually live that, like use that mindset to actually build on saving and build on getting down their debt. Because if they're not buying the knickknacks that they don't need or use, then they have that, it's only a little bit, they have that little bit of extra cash to put toward an emergency fund, a savings account, or something that, you know, they can throw that money at that is useful for them. I mean, it sounds like a selfish system for the person, but it's actually a more biblical and stable system in how we are to live financially balanced according to scripture. Correct me if I'm wrong on that one.
No, you're not at all. And that's, I think I said it in the first episode. The better our budget, the better our plan, the more we can see that we're buying a lot of things that we don't need to buy. In almost every case, the people that I work with are overspending anywhere from 500 to, it's anywhere from $500 to $1,500 that people are overspending on things like eating out, just silly things at the store that they don't need, all kinds of various entertainment and subscriptions that they don't need. You name it, they're overspending a lot of money and they're broke because of that, mixed with their payments. So once they get rid of the extra expenses and once they get rid of the payments, they really start to get a sense of freedom and they have a lot of income that they're able to now use for bigger, better purposes.
Yep. Amen. Well, Brennan, thank you so much for your wise insight on how we can make our money work for us. Listeners, stay tuned. We're going to be back next week with another episode on finances. So I look forward to seeing you guys then. Thank you, everyone, for joining us on this episode of Living Financially Balanced. I am urging all of my listeners to ask us questions about finances by submitting questions in two different formats. You can email me at earfulpodcast@gmail.com, or you can send us a question and be heard on our next episode via anchor.fm/elderqueen/message. This information will be in the show notes. We are asking that you also share this episode with others on your social media profiles and help us to get this podcast to those who are interested in listening to solid biblical ways of doing life. Again, thank you all and God bless you. Happy holidays. Stay tuned and let's learn some history.
Greetings. This is Steve Selyards, the author of The GA Junkie, and here are some Presbyterian history notes for the week of November 10th. Sunday, November 10th. Henry Van Dyke was born on this day in 1852. He was a son of the manse and began his career as a pastor in Rhode Island and New York City. The balance of his career was spent as an English literature professor at Princeton. He served as the ambassador to the Netherlands and Luxembourg from 1913 to 1916 at the beginning of World War I. This appointment came from his classmate at Princeton, fellow Presbyterian, and the President of the United States at that time, Woodrow Wilson. Van Dyke was a prolific author and poet and a hymn writer, best known for authoring the hymn, Joyful, Joyful, We Adore Thee. He also chaired the committee that assembled the 1906 PCUSA Book of Common Worship. He was elected the moderator of the 1876 PCUSA General Assembly. Monday, November 11th. On this day in 1825, the residents of Allegheny, Pennsylvania, petitioned the PCUSA for a seminary, and they granted a parcel of common land for that purpose. Western Theological Seminary was founded by the General Assembly 2 years later, and began instruction later that year. The permanent building on that land in Allegheny was ready in 1831. It was merged with Pittsburgh Xenia Theological Seminary in 1959, following the PCUSA-UPCNA merger to form the present Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, which is celebrating the 60th anniversary of this event this year. Tuesday, November 12th. Sticking with the theme of Pittsburgh for a moment, this day is the 150th anniversary of the National Presbyterian Convention in Pittsburgh in 1869. This meeting reunited the old school and new school sides of the PCUSA after a 32-year split. The southern old school and new school sides had reunited 5 years before. Wednesday, November 13th. On this day in 1640, Scottish commissioners from the Church of Scotland General Assembly arrived in London. These four commissioners, including Alexander Henderson, were sent to continue negotiations with King Charles, which followed on from the just-concluded Treaty of Ripon in Scotland. This work by the commissioners led to the 1641 Treaty of London 10 months later, after working with Parliament to secure rights for Covenanters. It also gave these ministers a pulpit in London to condemn episcopacy and promote Presbyterianism. Thursday, November 14th. In 1814, Stuart Robertson was born in Ireland. As a child, his family relocated to Virginia, and he served as a pastor in South Carolina, Kentucky, and Maryland. While a pastor, he also helped with a couple of Presbyterian publications, serving as the editor of the monthly newspaper, The Presbyterian Critic, and later he published a tabloid titled The True Presbyterian. For 2 years, he was a professor at the Theological Seminary at Danville, Kentucky. He spent some time towards the end of the Civil War preaching in Toronto at the invitation of a former student. He was unanimously elected as the moderator of the 1869 PCUS General Assembly. Friday, November 15th. This is the 225th anniversary of the death of John Witherspoon. He was the noted sixth president of the College of New Jersey from 1768 until his death, and the only clergy member to sign the Declaration of Independence. He was born in Scotland and was recruited from his pastorate there to serve as the college president. He was selected to convene the first General Assembly of the PCUSA in 1789 and to preside until the Reverend John Rogers was formally elected the moderator. Saturday, November 16th, in 1861, Reverend William Miller died. He was born in Scotland and trained with the Associate Presbytery there. He moved to Canada and was the first resident Presbyterian minister on Cape Breton Island, beginning in 1821, where he served the rest of his career. Thank you for joining me here on the EAR podcast, and I look forward to joining you again next week.
You have reached the end of yet another episode from The Ear. We hope that God's word remains on the ears of the listeners. We pray that this podcast would urge you to go forth and spread His good news to the world. Thank you for tuning in. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. See you at the next episode. God bless you, and may His glory shine upon you.